Does that make sense? So it's really hard to embrace those parts of yourself, which almost embarrass you or lead you, because your greatest strengths become your greatest weaknesses.
And because not everybody appreciates our uniqueness. And so it can be a characteristic that people always told you was a bad thing that happens to be your friend's favorite thing about you. They don't love you despite your flaws. Sometimes they love those quirks, or they love the areas where you're a little bit outside of what is considered socially acceptable.
Hi, I'm Coach MK, founder of the Fitness Protection Program. I'm a run coach, not a life coach. We're never really talking about the running. Running is the tool. It's the conduit we use to examine the world we live in, as well as its impact on our own lives and the lives of the people around us. How we react to certain people and to certain stories tells us a lot about how we view ourselves. I'm committed to the thoughtful, intentional exploration of the importance of running so that no one discounts their own badassery, ever. Final note, this podcast is geared towards every runner who won't lose their home, livelihood, or health insurance if they show up to the corral with a hangover. Not that I'm encouraging you to do that, just saying. Sit back, relax, and enjoy the Fitness Protection Podcast.
You know, sometimes you let your Harvard hang out, Coach Sarah. I'm about to
when I clap in a synchronized manner.
Just saying. Well, I'm about to show you my age. I let my age hang out here. You ready for this?
Mm-hmm.
I love myself. I think I'm grand. When I go to the movies, I hold my hand. I wrap my arms around my waist. When I get fresh, I slap my face. I'm a nut. Do you know that song?
Yeah, I do.
You do, really? Oh my gosh.
I do.
That's amazing. I figured that was like, I learned that in junior high from a girl named Deanne Graves. I remember very clearly. I'd never heard it before, which is just shocking to me. That would have been what, 1991? Had your parents even met yet then?
Oh, yeah. Come on. 1991, I was like fully in elementary school, MK.
So you girls, you sang this at your private girls' Catholic school.
Oh, for sure. No, it wasn't a Catholic school, but it was very anti lots of things, including probably lots of things in this song. Actually, I know it because it's been like kidified into a kid version. And there's a kid version of it on like the Amazon what? Kids channel. I'm an acorn small and round, lying on the cold, cold ground. That's because I am cracked, you see. I'm a nut. And I did know that there was an original and that it was like a little, I don't know, problematic because
that's all I know of the song. There might be more of it, but that's all I've ever heard. So I really think that that's kind of interesting when I sit back and think about it, though, because back then, self-love, and we're going to pretend this song is about self-love, right?
Not about acorns. You know,
not acorns or other things, but like back then, self-love made you a nut. The cultural conversation around this concept has really shifted in the ensuing 20 years to the point that not loving yourself is a source of shame. And we're still like trapped somewhere between the right answer and the true answer. I love myself being the right answer, and I am perpetually frustrated by my body on the other. We aren't sure that weight loss and cosmetic procedures like facelifts or nose jobs can be acts of self-love. And we have shows like The Biggest Loser and Botched to totally prove it. Which I gotta say, after my sinoplasty last week, not a rhinoplasty. Rhinoplasty changes the way your nose looks, and sinoplasty changes the way the sinuses behind it, that the parts that your nose protect, the way that those function. And oh my gosh, I watched a whole lot of Cheer and a whole lot of Botched. And as much as I like that show, there is a little undercurrent of the fact it were implying that people don't like things. Obviously, you're in there to change something about yourself. This is a team of doctors who are fixing surgeries gone wrong. From people who wanted to change parts of their bodies so badly, they went to less than reputable doctors or took chances to make that happen. And those bets were not necessarily good ones. So when we think about that, and this is why the body positivity movement, can someone who's had a lot of cosmetic procedures be present in the body positivity movement? It's been interesting to sort of watch that conversation play out in different places. There was a woman in the UK, a TV anchor, who wrote a book called Body Positive, and that talked about her journey to self-love. And it was critically panned, saying, how dare you write a book like this when you've had a lot of plastic surgery? She's like, one doesn't beget the other. Like, it's my journey, and this my journey involved it. So it's an interesting conversation about who we're willing to listen to at this point, who can be a role model for this and who can't, who can talk about it and who we don't want to hear from. Granted, that in and of itself is problematic, but at the end of the day, I will never stop thinking about how the right answer is, you got to love yourself. And the true answer is, we don't have cultural support to learn that, to embrace it, or to do that continually, much less reconcile that with the impulses we have. Like, I just really want to lose 5 pounds, which is a valid desire without shaming people. So this is really what makes Valentine's Day really, really tough. Quitter's Day is a thing now, a shame-laden mid-January marketing pitch to keep sales momentum from New Year's going strong into a month centered around a holiday, ostensibly celebrating romantic love. Another type of love we aren't comfortable having for ourselves. We're not going to talk about that on this podcast, by the way, because I might melt into a puddle and die. Because, like, seriously, I'm all for people doing whatever solo, doing anything in your bedroom. I just don't want to know about it. That is why we hired Coach Sarah. You can tell her about your vibrator. She's here for, I'm just kidding. No, she might not. I can't. I'm really old, y'all. I'm old.
Call the HR department.
See, I didn't know you were the go-to person for that, Sarah.
This is the first time hearing of it.
This is why I didn't want to formalize your job description too quickly, Sarah.
Now I get it.
Oh my God.
I actually really don't give a shit about your vibrator. If you love it and you have recommendations to make, come to me with them. It's not, I won't melt or like fall in a hole and die. I'm not saying that I have curiosity about your vibrator, but.
You're not looking for recommendations, but you will listen if someone wants to
I'm
share.
A very good listener. I am a very good listener.
I judge absolutely nothing. But there's some things I hear and I'm like, I feel like I have too much knowledge about a person. And I think when you're having intimate conversations with people doing emotional labor the way that we do, you have to have some lines and some boundaries. And that's one I have to have because, like, a favorite question, and this is one I used to get in office hours all the time where I'm like, people are like, hey, okay, I know it's like, I need to get rid of some nervous energy and like, I just need to calm down. So it's okay to have sex the day before a race, right? Or the night before. And I'm like, there's a part of me that will always be like, what kind of sex could you possibly be having that could impact your race the next day?
What are you? My question.
And if so, I don't want to know about it. What? Can you really not wait 24 hours?
It is a super common question, though. It gets that like people talk about it on Twitter all the time. Like, it's a thing. Wow. I don't understand why it's a thing. It's very weird to me.
That is really interesting. I would not have guessed that.
It's one of the most common questions, and I don't understand. And which it goes back to what I was saying about like we need to think hard about communication and the rules people have and make up. I'm like, well, how much energy are you expending? What kind of positions? Like, Jesus right. Christ, how much is sex taking out of you that you're worried right. you won't have enough for your half marathon tomorrow?
But it's funny, there's a lot of misinformation out there about how much energy that really requires.
Yes.
Because I see people being really generous about what kind of calorie burn they think they're going to get from, what, 10 minutes of doing that? Let's get serious. And maybe some people, it's 30 minutes, maybe some people it's an hour, but the overwhelming average, according to research, is 20 minutes and under. Y'all will be fine. I mean, it's not burning nearly the calories that people try and tell themselves it does. And a lot of times when you see those calorie counts, they also count the calories you would have burned just sitting in a chair, staring out into space, right? That they add like the little 50 calories on top of it. And they're like, woo, woo, just do that. Eat all the cookies, you know, and then go do that. But that's not a thing.
I would love to see someone record it, their heart rate monitor, and post it to Strava.
I bet they'd be really just disappointed saying, once they see how few calories they burned.
If Strava became a place where people posted those sessions, I would not be safe for me anymore. Ah, this is about, I'm really old. Like, I talk about these things. I just literally don't want to know. I'm all for all kinds of partnerships. There's so much I don't care about, but that doesn't mean I want to hear about it either. You do you over there.
Anywho.
We know we can't really love our people until we truly love ourselves. But how do we do that exactly on a mental, not physical level? Because we're going to talk about that mental level here today. In order to have that conversation, needed to bring in the big guns to facilitate. So Jimmy Olawale is a Gottman Method therapist, and Dahlia Kinsey is the school nutrition dietitian. Together, they are the big guns. We are going to take on diet culture and explore that intersection between body image, fitness, and wellness to talk about and celebrate good choices. Yay! So here's this question I really want to start with. Dahlia, do you love yourself? When did that start and how did you know?
I would say, yes, I definitely do. And it probably started in my early 20s and definitely not teen years up until then. And it was a process. I remember Louise Hay, like there's a lot of things she says in her work that can be problematic, like some victim blamey stuff, but a lot of her work is really useful. So she suggests that people do mirror work, which is basically super cheesy self-help work where you look in the mirror and you tell yourself you love yourself. And it sounds like meaningless.
It's attachment therapy. Yeah.
Right. But then when you do it and you can't say it without getting very upset, then you know you have a real problem. So that was, I guess just a signal that I had a lot of work to do. But then just the way I was raised, so much of the messaging.
How old were you? I'm sorry?
Probably 24.
When you tried the mirror thing?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Because I didn't officially decide that I was going to break away from how I was raised, which wasn't healthy for me personally, until around that age. So I was always told that your relationship to yourself was inconsequential and your relationship to even others is not very important. Your relationship to God is the biggest thing, and that we are but dust. We are but, you know,
we don't matter.
Less than roaches, we're worthless and we're sinful.
So grateful for whatever we get.
Exactly. Yeah. So the concept of trying to love myself, knowing that it was only because of grace that I even was alive, not because I was inherently worthy or because maybe the divine actually wanted me to be here and didn't think I was a turd or whatever. I hadn't thought about the concept until I said, you know what? All of that's not working for me. I didn't know what was going to come next. And that was a starting point. Louise there was like the entry. And then I started traditional therapy and CBT. And I maybe 28 started to feel like I could kind of tolerate myself. And then I started having issues with more secular messaging and feeling like I was getting really old because I was in my late 20s. And that was a whole thing in itself. But now at 38, I feel like I totally accept myself. And there are messages I'll hear from people now that would have totally broken me down 10 years ago that now I'm like, okay, whatever, that's how you feel. Because I was constantly being told as a child that I was too blunt, that my razor sharp wit was offensive, and that basically I was a bitch. I was a mini bitch. And people would compare me to my mother, who I already knew what people said about her.
Yeah.
And so, but now when people say that, I'm like, okay, well, I guess I'm not for you then. You know, I'm not for everybody. And what? I love me. I felt like I needed to say that. And so I said it, and you're welcome to feel however you want about it.
Mm-hmm. It's hard. That was very much me too. Like even when I was being quiet, I was too loud. Anything I said incorrectly. And, you know, it's like, MK, it's the problem isn't the world. The problem is you. And I'm like, but I get straight A's. I don't do anything wrong. I haven't shared my opinion. What in the world? I'm too opinionated just because I disagreed a little bit. I didn't even disagree vehemently. Or I didn't in a way that called you out. I tried to help you, giving you a subtle correction as you like spoke incorrect information. I remember there was a time I was really young, but somebody said the wrong date and I was like, six. You mean six? I got in so much trouble. So I'm just supposed to let the mistake happen. And it's like, this isn't your room. And no, you're not supposed to care. And you're supposed to keep your mouth shut and be there. And all you did was make him feel bad and make him embarrassed because you drew attention publicly to the fact that this man made a mistake. And I'm like, I still don't get that logic.
Right.
But now, 30 years later, I can see how everything in this world was designed to protect the ego of the truly most fragile person here, which is, you know, a dude, as opposed to us being the fragile ones at all. There was a death over the weekend. I don't know if you saw the obituary in the New York Times, but the woman was considered to be the founder of the anti-psychiatry movement because she said she was the first to call out, as a Canadian woman, the first to call out that psychiatry was inherently patriarchal and the things that it labeled as crazy or deviant behaviors were actually totally normal responses to situations that the men who had written the rules would never experience. And I'll put that in the show notes. I'm aware. I don't want to throw the name out because it people who know respond the same way to this name as they do other names I could throw out there, like a woman who gave a speech over the weekend about how she's not going to run for president again. I'd rather not say her name because people stop listening. I will put a link to this obituary in the show notes. And if this her work sounds interesting to you, I'd say go take a look. It's the reason why a lot of us have to therapist shop. To find someone that who gets us and who sees us not as the problem specifically, but can help us talk about things like rape culture, diet culture, the culture and the forces that society exudes on us, acknowledging those while examining our responses to them. You really can't have one without the other. Lucky for y'all, we already found the best therapist ever and brought her here directly to you, Jimmy, Dr. Olawale.
Oh, Lord God. Hi, everyone.
Isn't that a good intro?
It's a pretty great intro.
I mean, she deserves it for the hair. Your hair looks amazing.
Totally.
New braids? Sorry, I don't have my glasses. The braids are twists. Braids.
They are old. They are braids.
Oh, well, they still look good.
Yeah, they're crochets.
Oh, nice.
I love it.
Yeah. Thank you, y'all.
So you had a busy weekend, I take it.
Is it that fun?
Jeez. I'm just saying, one of my roommates in college, when the braids were on, that's because something had gone off the rails. And maybe that's not a psychoanalysis I need to make about every person I see with braids, but I was just giving you space to talk about it.
It takes a long time to get done, but these have been done for right before Christmas. They actually need to come out, but it looks great at the bottom, but the roots is where the issue is because that's where all my, you know, my hair keeps growing underneath.
Now I can see it. I can see it at first.
You see all that black? You see, it's no longer pretty and gold and blonde anymore. It's just what I need is actually one of those bands.
Yes, yes. Then you can wear it a lot
right here.
Is that why people wear them?
That's why some people wear them when their hair grows out.
Never
or even when their when their hair dye grows out. I've seen people pull that move. I'm like, girl, just get it done.
I've got this oddly misshapen head where wraparounds won't stay in place. My head is so, I'm deformed and I can't wear those. So I'm always fascinated by people who do because they look really neat. But for me, I'm adjusting it all the time. So it's so distracting. I'd almost rather not. But yeah, like, God, I wish I had known that trick back when I was like waiting back when I used to color my hair and things would grow in. Like, oh, I could.
Oh, you don't color your hair anymore?
Mm-mm. I've been pregnant for 7 years, Dahlia. And now I got four kids. The last fuck no, I'm not going to this hair salon for 3 hours.
I honestly thought you intentionally, the way your grays are in there, I thought that was on purpose. Like you dye around it and control for it, like a highlight.
It's manifest destiny.
Well, it's good. So you look like a Pantene commercial and you look like you intentionally put highlights in your hair.
Thank you. I wish I could take credit for that. I've always wanted to be a silver female fox, and I can't wait for it to all go white. My Nana, my mother's sister, the kids, my kid, her name's Diana, Aunt Diane to me, but my kids call her Nana. She at 58 had already gone gray, never colors it, but it's moving from gray to white, and it's gorgeous. And people stop around the street. And this is the sort of attention my Nana has never gotten in her life. And I love the fact that now she's really coming into her own with like, yeah, I travel too much to dye my hair. And anyway, I have to put a picture in the show notes too. Her hair looks amazing. It looks like it's professionally done, but this is just the natural color. And she's more happy and more content, especially with her hair, than she's ever been. All the years fighting gray, and now it's like gray is, it works for her. And I kind of, there's something about that I love that I think is worth talking about for Valentine's Day.
Oh, yeah. I love that, that people are celebrating. That's something I think a lot of us don't do enough. Well, if you live in the South, you probably do it all the time. But sometimes in other parts of the country where people don't talk to strangers, when you see that somebody looks really great or something about them is very pretty, you don't say anything. Like, I think it's normal to go up to someone and say, oh my God, your eyes are ridiculous. Like, they're so pretty or whatever. And the people just take the compliment, go on about their day. But if you do that in other areas, people think that's weird. My husband gets stuffed all the time because of his hair. It's totally white. And that's how all of his siblings have grayed. And that's how their mother grayed. My parents still don't have gray hair. And my grandma's hair never turned totally gray. And she's in her 90s. She dyes it so that it'll be silver. So I'm probably just going to have patches. I would love for it to all go gray.
Oh my God. I would love to see that too. That would be super cool. I'm trying to picture you with it. But it's hard, also hard to believe you're 38 because you look 28.
Thank you. Amazing. Yeah, definitely amazing. 38. Solid 38.
And loving it.
Yes. Yeah, it's surprising. It's better than 28 was for me. I feel like I know myself better. I feel like I'm more excited about aging. And like, I bet your aunt never knew that people thought totally gray hair was beautiful, because you really don't see it on TV. You don't see it in magazines as being beautiful, but in reality, it is undeniably beautiful.
Well, it was an ageism thing, right? Because no one would put, the assumption was no one wants to see an old person. No one wants to see this, or this, anything that resembled the signs of aging would be a turnoff. So there was never an opportunity to showcase like we have now. And I think it's really interesting and fun to see. I don't think it's shutting avenues anywhere. If anything, it's opened everything up for more and new standards of beauty. So, yeah. Jamie, the question that I just threw at Dahlia before you popped into the room, as a therapist, and I would never say that, you know, healer, heal thyself, which is why some people go into therapy in the first place, but you share whatever truth you want. It doesn't have to be the truth, just whatever your truth is that people need to hear. Do you love yourself? When did that start? And how did you know you've gotten there?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Emphatically, yes, I love myself. It has not always been that way. I think it has ebbed and flowed over the years. But I think that I started really coming into my own in my 30s. I think something just happens when you turn 30 plus. I don't know, maybe it's because of the fully developed, you know, prefrontal cortex. I have no idea. But it was in my 30s that, and after I had my children, I think after I had my daughter, was when I started really feeling like I was growing into myself. I think having children really helped that process, to catalyze that process. And how I know is because I'm much kinder to myself. The obnoxious neighbor in my head is not as loud as she used to be. She's tamed. It doesn't mean that she doesn't speak, because she loves to chat. Like my daughter would say, she's a chatterbox, but she's tamed. I have a lot of compassion, more compassion for people. And I think that's because I have more compassion for myself. I am very, very quick to just forgive things and keep it moving. I am much more open. So I see how I'm able to feel about people, but I think it's because I'm able to feel like that about myself. And I couldn't reach this level of empathy and kindness without actually being able to give that to myself first.
Totally feel that. So was there a day you woke up and you were like, oh, I'm good? Because when we talk about love in general, it's kind of problematic in the respect that it's not helpful. And if your experience doesn't match the narrative you've been taught, you can question whether or not what you have is real, is legit, or if you're there yet, right? So we'd like to talk about love being this irresponsible thing, like a comet that comes once in a lifetime. It knocks you down. It burns things, everything to the ground. It disrupts it all. And so anything that's kind of muted and comfortable, we're like, but I'm bored. And it's like, but boring is great. That's the definition of stability. Let's think about, life might be really exciting in countries with constant military coups, But that's not inherently stable. And this is really what you're inviting into your life, an ongoing series of hard fights and military coups, or, you know, maybe not your first choice, but at the same time, not a bad choice. And I say this as someone who loves my husband so completely, but I don't talk about him in those terms. Like, I hate it when people ask me that question. How do you keep it spicy? And I'm like, ugh, once again, none of your business.
Well, that's the whole thing. I don't know who these people are. You missed it, Juby. I mean, people are asking some very interesting questions of MK.
Ooh, yeah. Well, because it's also a thing. It's even in like casual conversation, it's like a bonding thing with like people talking about their marriages and how do you keep things spicy? And I'm like, well, if I answer that, then I'm going to have to hear how you do it. And I don't want to. So I'm just going to opt out and thank God for my smartphone and get really absorbed, which is something I didn't have a decade ago and would just sit there like.
I think they need to question what they're looking at, what their expectations are. I was raised with the expectation that real love, romantic love that lasts over time, is muted. It's not exciting. That's lust. That's passion. That's what you feel at the beginning of a relationship. And it's very fun. And sometimes people think that's love because that's the part that's featured in romantic comedies. They don't follow them until, you know, the hooking up gets boring because it's boring, but that's normal and supposed to happen. You have that strong initial interest. And if it doesn't grow into something more muted, it's not sustainable. And if you leave that relationship looking for that flame or that interest again, if you don't pay attention, you may never notice that it always fades. You don't need to change the relationship. Your expectations may not be realistic for a long-term relationship. And maybe you don't like long-term relationships. I don't know. But if you're going to be in one, to expect for it to be as fun as what they portray in a rom-com is not realistic because that is the early stages. That is the honeymoon phase. That is not usually how it goes. You become friends. You almost become family. Like, my husband gets on my nerves and what's like, I don't even know what that means, but he's my family. Like, I would no sooner say, well, I'm going to get a new sister than I would say, I'm going to get a new Terry. Like, he's family now. He's part of my life. I expect to see him every day. But spice, what's that? You know, I mean,
it's what's in I carry in my purse on the way to white people's houses for all the bland food that's going to be waiting for me.
Listen, I think that, you know, I think you're so right about the fact that like relationships ebbs and flows depending on the stages that they're in. I think that what is best for you in terms of spice is what works for the relationship, right? So what spicy may look like or what muted may look like for different people is going to be different. And, you know, I don't believe in comparing my relationship to other people's relationship because there's just some things that would not work in my relationship that may work in yours and vice versa. I don't think that, you know, being addicted to this idea of excitement, like the one that you had from the beginning, is a very healthy stance. I do believe that there's a way that you can have life and fun and enjoyment in your relationship that works for the two of you, right? And, you know, there's this idea that even when you're married to one person, you're going to be married to that one person multiple times in one marriage, right? Because you're both constantly evolving. You're both, you know, going to change. And the marriages that are successful, the marriages that are fun, the marriages that people really enjoy are the ones that are open to change. So if you're willing to change with the change, understanding that your wife is going to change, your husband is going to change, whether you're in a heterosexual relationship or a homosexual relationship, it really doesn't matter. Being willing to change with that change is what makes it, you know, sustainable, is what makes it enjoyable for the partners. So yes, the marriage you had at the beginning is not going to be the same marriage you have like 15 years in and not the one that you had 35 years in. And if it is the same, that's a whole different conversation.
And I think it's interesting what you said about the ebbs and flows in a relationship with another person. They can also, they're like tides that rise and fall, like the relationships that we have with ourselves. And I think that's an important thing to note. Like, you're not expected to love yourself all the time. There's a long period of figuring things out that previous generations didn't get to do because life was a whole lot harder. The things we don't talk about when we talk about like the period pieces like The Help and Mad Men, which kind of maybe romanticizes the right word. Maybe that's too strong a word. I don't know.
But I like think you that don't is see. Exactly what it does. So, yes.
Yeah. What we don't talk about like is like women had, it was possible to get more help then than it is now for a whole bunch of reasons. that are really good. It is harder to do things now. The expectations are greater. Child rearing is considered a very different thing now than it was before. It looked more like sort of the posh British model of a distance between like the mother's function in a home in they'd say like Catherine Middleton's job would be in the UK looked not that different from what a mom in an upper class family that could afford help in Jackson, Mississippi would look like in the 60s, where like, what are you doing all day? Not child rearing, not like in it with the kids. Like you are doing other sorts of things that things that were playing cards all day long, playing bridge, going to being member, things that we women don't really have the time and space to do now. So acknowledging the differences that like this is also an opportunity, the ebbs and flows are there, that's new. But also when we talk about spicing up a relationship, it automatically goes to somewhere sexual that I don't want to go. And I'm like, when you want to spice up your relationship with yourself, that's what interests me more. And not the sex component that you can tell Coach Sarah about because she wants to hear that stuff. I don't. But
Just keep saying it.
Same. Please, God, do not.
Well, let's talk about me. It.
God, you can tell. You can pay.
I'm changing all my email addresses now.
Wait. If you think back to a guy, and I say this like, or if you're listening to this, like the person that you dated. And that nobody wanted you to date, that made you feel like crap. And you'd be like, okay, you're venting. This is clearly not a good relationship. Why are you with him or her? I love them. Could you describe that? No, I just do. I wish we could have that same sort of dogged attachment to ourselves, but I'm really whatever. And I'm this and I'm that, but I love me. Now, why can't we advocate for ourselves the way we advocated for a crappy significant other when we were like 14 or 29 or 32, 52?
Oh, I think that's hard. Oh, no, go ahead, Jillian.
Did I just dive deep there?
Yeah, you did.
I want to know how we can do it. I'm listening to Jimmy.
Oh, really? You're gonna pass the ball?
You're the therapist. She is the dietitian. Yeah. Just
tee it up. Tee it up.
I think that's difficult, right? Because you know we do live in a system, whether we like it or not, that there are certain ways that things move and there's certain rules that apply that makes it really difficult for us to kind of step out of the ways that things are done. So in our society, the idea of romance and stuff like that is something that is very much seen as the end all be all. The idea that you're going to love yourself is typically seen as something that is very indulgent and selfish. And, you know, even when we think about religion, loving others means sacrificing yourself for them. So it's you disappearing. And so how do you do that when you live in, you know, a culture that tells you that you should be smaller, right? So that others can be bigger. And I think this is where a lot of problems in relationships also occur, especially for us women, is that we need to be smaller for our partners to be bigger. We need to give for them to be better. You know, so it's because of that, it's hard to think about loving yourself in that way and having that focus. It's a real major mind shift that takes a long, long time because we are wired. We are all swimming in that water. We're all buried in that water. We've all been baptized in that water before we were born. And to do it differently just feels so different because everyone around you is going to be telling you that you're being selfish. And I think this is what I love about being in my 30s is the fact that it's like, you know, Jung said, I'm kind of young in my therapeutic approach, that it's really about developmental stages, that when you get into this type of age, you care less about what people are doing on the outside and you focus more on that internal drive. So it also depends on what age you're in, because if you're in your 20s and everybody around you is looking for something different, you're going to feel kind of weird talking about, you know, sort of your internal stuff, because even the people who are around you don't have that language. So I think starting with the language is helpful. And when we're able to say it, you know, for those of us who are in our 30s and even in their 20s or in their teens, when we can start talking about it like we're doing on this podcast, saying it out loud that it's okay, I think it gives other people a different place to look at and understand that it's possible for you to be able to love yourself. Not every day, not perfectly, but yes. And that love that you have for yourself is what you're bringing to the relationship. Because without that, what are you bringing? I mean, really, what are you bringing?
It all goes back to RuPaul. I don't know if anyone has been listening to the playlist where he says, and he's been saying this for years, if you can't love yourself, how in the hell are you going to love somebody else? And it's so true. The more you start feeling compassionate about your own flaws and you start to accept yourself, the more you find that you can accept others. And the people that are the most rigid, the most critical, that have so many relationships in their life that they have decided to throw away, usually are really struggling with self-acceptance as well, because they have zero tolerance for their own BS and they have zero tolerance for anybody else's. But that's a very lonely place to be. Nobody's perfect. And that's okay. And of course, you should have boundaries, and there's some issues that you should not tolerate in your life. But if you're waiting for everyone to be perfect, and the moment somebody transgresses, you know that they're canceled, that is kind of a problem.
Totally. And it's especially, again, not to keep bringing it back, but if you're thinking about yourself, which perfectionists, like certain people who shall remain nameless, I feel like maybe on some level tend to do. Like, this mistake is proof that I am the ugliest possible narrative of who I am as a person. This is proof that I'm not capable. And now I have to work against that to mitigate it. And we assign it more weight than it's due. And the reason, again, for that, that's valid. There have been times and places that certain demographics have been allowed to get away with mistakes and others have not. So if you feel that, that's been conditioned in you, that's real. The question is, like, how do you get out of that space once you're into it, to trust that you're finally in a safe place where you can actually be and do and truly embrace those things that make you you? I can tell you all every day not to talk about Coach Sarah like she isn't sitting right here staring at me in the camera as I point at her. But like, I could tell you all the things that I adore about her and what jumped out on the phone at me the very first time I spoke to her on the phone back in 2016. And all of those things she would probably like cringe at and want to sue me for later on this podcast for putting out into the world, because she might not see them as positive attributes. Does that make sense? So it's really hard to embrace those parts of yourself, which almost embarrass you or lead you, because your greatest strengths become your greatest weaknesses.
And because not everybody appreciates our uniqueness. And so it can be a characteristic that people always told you was a bad thing that happens to be your friend's favorite thing about you. They don't love you despite your flaws. Sometimes they love those quirks, or they love the areas where you're a little bit outside of what is considered socially acceptable. Some people find that refreshing and they literally can't get enough of it. And I think when you've been criticized a lot in early childhood, you keep thinking, oh, well, it's going to hit a breaking point and then my personality will be too much and they'll run away. Or if I'm too much myself, I'm going to find that there really is a way to be too much myself. But there really isn't. If you're not hurting other people, it really is possible that you can just be yourself and that your tribe will be drawn to you. And there's no way to be too much you.
Well, if there's one thing that I think our society does teach us that is unappealing about us, is a high level of emotion and displaying a lot of emotions. And when I was thinking about, when MK was asking everyone else, do you love yourself? And I was thinking about that question. I'm the young in here. I'm 33. So I know I have a ways to go on this. And the thing that I am really struggling with right now, like in therapy, is the fact that being an emotional person, which I am, is something that I have believed for my entire life is my greatest weakness and that I need to hide it. And this really smacked me in the face this morning. I was reading Ask Polly on The Cut, and this sentence really jumped out at me. She says, next level overachievers are on a lifelong quest to overcome all weakness. Skipping down a little bit because this is a long paragraph. Your central precept, she's speaking to the letter writer who wrote in, whether you are aware of it or not, was that emotion itself is weakness, and that all things that blossom from emotion are in turn weak, deluded, or broken. And I was like, okay, well, that's me. And it's very hard.
You are
hard.
Not neither weak, deluded, nor broken in any possible way.
Well, thank you. I want to and am working on believing that. But if I'm being real with myself, I don't yet. I feel like the work that I'm doing right now is letting myself see all the ways in which that is so wrong. The fact that the emotional side of me is something that is a weakness and that I need to compensate for. But truly, it is difficult to love other people when you worry about how emotional you're being. It is very difficult to love yourself when you are worried about how emotional you are being. I think that love is very tied up in all of this. And it's certainly something that I relate to very deeply. So, you know, if you're listening to this and thinking that you can't honestly say that you love yourself yet. I believe that we're going to get there, but I also see how much work it feels like sometimes. I really do.
Well, I know for me, I did not feel that until I was 37. And the day that I recognized it was, and honestly, because it sneaks up on you, there's the moment that you know it. And it's like maybe, because it's always a process. And it's, if it's not one that you're consciously working on, then the outcome jumps out at you, which is what I hope I want everyone to have in the training plans, right? You do the training and then you have this race day and it feels really amazing without crushing yourself during the process of preparation, because that doesn't really improve the outcome. The day I truly recognized it was when an agent called me. And this is someone that who I don't know personally, but represents people who I do know who are legit. Like they're on the speaker circuit. They do bigger things. They're paid to show up and talk. So this person approached me and was like, I would like to start working on your personal brand. I heard you on a podcast and I was very interested. And I was like, I took a deep breath and my gut reaction was just like, I'm not ready. And I was like, no, give me a little time. This is 2016. I'm like, I've just gotten here. I've got a lot going on right now, but I can tell you this. If I was going to devote what little spare time I have into building something, it would have to be something bigger than I am and reach farther, because now I'm in a position where I've seen what the need is for this type of service and I need to go figure that out. And I remember getting off the phone and looking at my husband, who was like, did that just happen? You just said no. And I'm like, now I got to defend that now. And I just smiled and was like, yeah, I did. Isn't that cool? And he was horrified because he was like, you know, isn't this what you've wanted? And I'm like, what? Yeah, yes, it's exactly what I wanted to be in such a good place that I could turn away something that I would have jumped at 10 years ago, because it had been such a journey to get to a place. Like that was the moment I realized that I felt good and I had come into my own. And for once, people did want to hear me speak. And I wasn't too loud or too smart, too different, too bold, too opinionated. I might be a little too wordy. I might still talk a little too much, but I've got a place to do it that's not stealing time, air, or oxygen away from other people, other than you guys on the occasion. And I'm sorry for that. It's Coach Sarah constantly, which you're sorry for that too. I tell you all that to tell you this. If you are not there yet, cool. You're by no means behind. If what you're seeing now with me and with Dahlia is, I wouldn't say we're done, but there's a hump and we're definitely over it. And we can't wait to bring everyone else there to be in a good place with you and who you are and your body and your relationship with food and your relationship with yourself. And if we could do one thing this Valentine's Day, one step, and I wish Jimmy hadn't had to jump off, because like now we're about to move into something that I learned to do in cognitive behavior therapy, which CBT, cognitive behavior therapy, is all about changing that narrative in your brain about yourself. And it's really hard to do. And it doesn't look the same thing for like no two people will have the same experience going to CBT. What it looked like for me when I did it started with, what do you have to work with? So if you've heard the central MK questions, anything you do, what do I need to get? And then the very next question is always, what do I have to work with? Because you've got more than you think you do. Chances are, if you're focusing on the absence of the things that you don't have, you aren't actually leveraging what you have at your disposal. We all have more than we think that we do. So doesn't mean we all have enough, but we all have something. So with that, I would say, like, what do we have to work with? Maybe it's just acknowledging and looking for that one thing. You know what? It doesn't have to be the best thing or the most useful thing, but it's a place to start. Looking in the mirror and being like, what's one thing I love about myself? What's one thing I don't hate? What part of me causes me the least stress? For me, it was my hair. I got great hair. I love my hair. It's really thick. When I dry it, it's pretty. Is it your fingernails, Sarah?
It's my hands. I talked about that in the Coach and Love newsletter a couple of weeks ago. That's why I decided to start painting my fingernails more often, because all through my struggles with my body as a high school kid, as a college student, I never stopped loving my hands and not only how they looked, but what they could do.
That's awesome. Like yeah. I got these mangled, crooked fingers that I'm told are very, I've always been teased about it. They look very strange. So, I don't love my hands, but I don't necessarily hate them either. But I feel like when you think about that dogged advocacy that you pursued for that person that you're in a terrible relationship with way back when, and you could hear all the defenses you make for them, you would cringe now. The process of starting to apply some of that towards yourself starts with finding the one thing that you don't hate, or like, what is, okay, so there are like of this guy treats you terribly, because I dated men. This guy treats you terribly. Why are you still here? Well, he's this, 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 this. And you had your answer. I would like you to like start finding those things about yourself so that you can hear my voice in your head until yours is ready to take over. And it's like, oh, I'm really fat and really slow. But you know what? Your legs move and you have, and you get up and you move them. That's amazing. I'm, you know, I half-ass things. That's what makes you consistent showing up. So hell yeah for half-ass. That's going to be an upcoming mantra, by the way. Hell yeah for half-ass. But I love
it. It's tricky. I mean, I would ask too, ask the people that you trust and love in your life too, what are some of their favorite characteristics about you, or what do they know they can always depend on you for? Because some people, depending on what type of body you're in, you may really struggle to find things that you like about your body. If your health is declining, if you have a new disability that's difficult for you to accept, but there's still so much that you're doing and so much that you're bringing to other people, you may just not be giving yourself any credit.
I think the highest compliment I've ever gotten, or the one that I remember getting after I became somewhat more of a public figure than I used to be, someone saying, you know, you just make me feel incredibly safe. And it's something I don't feel anywhere else. And that's when I was like, well, I don't know that you can put that on a resume. And that's how I had thought about things, right? If it doesn't fit in on my resume, then I can't leverage it and it's worthless.
But that's only patriarchal bullet points. You know, those are all things that are super quantified. You could never put, oh, I have high emotional intelligence on a resume. No one even tries to quantify that because it's really not valued so much in our society. And that's something to dissect too. If you find a therapist, depending on whether or not this is your interest, some people don't want to go this deep with your therapy. But the therapist that I've resonated with the most did look at that, like how society was influencing my self-perception, since that's the lens that you typically see yourself through until you make a deliberate effort to stop doing that. Like, why don't you value high emotional intelligence? Did you have a teacher that told you your argument in debate club or whatever was trash because you actually felt drawn to one moral argument versus another? Like, there have been plenty of times in academic settings where I've seen a male or a very, what's the word for a brainwashed woman? I don't know. Or like a femme presenting person who basically is also projecting all these misogynistic ideas about what types of skills are good and what types of skills are inconsequential. I've seen people be attacked because they were basically presenting in too feminine of a way, and that has no value in certain settings. And I wonder what that does, because I even see it now since I'm around kids all the time. I just wonder what the difference is between the kid who hears that stuff and ignores it and the kid who's going to need a lot of therapy, you know, like me. I don't know what the difference is.
You know, neither do we. But what I do know is this, starting with that one thing that you don't hate about yourself. Doesn't have to be love. Like, the goal is to get neutral, if nothing else. It really is a journey. And it starts with finding that one thing that maybe don't hate and clinging to it like a life raft. But I'm this, but I got great hair. You know what? I got great hair. I have opinions, which means that I think things through, understand them, and acquire knowledge. I am resonating and responding to things around me. That means I'm sentient and involved. Like, anything that you think is a flaw about yourself, in CBT, I learned how to turn into a positive attribute and talk my way out of that eventually, which doesn't mean that I have like this deluded notion of what who I am and what I can do. But it also means that I'm not living in the worst possible narrative of myself all the time, trying to correct it, picking the meanest person in the room to try to win over as though I'm going to get a bigger medal for that. And instead looking for the places where I fit and inserting myself into things that feel easy, including my marriage, instead of looking for the spice and complication of things and conflating momentary feel good with long-term actual deep resonant love. It's process. You are by no means behind wherever you are. And I do hope this Valentine's Day, if you are unable to find one thing that you like about yourself and you're listening to this podcast, email me. coach, sorry, MK, what is my email address? MK at coachedinlove.com. Oh my God.
That one.
Oh no, I got too many. Yeah. MK at coachedinlove.com. Email me there or get ready and throw it in the chat on the live stream on the Sunday night after Valentine's Day. And I will tell you exactly what I admire and love about you.
Yeah.
I love that.
There we go. Thank you for being here, ladies. Thank you for letting us eat chew up more of your time and brain space. But you know, you are the big guns and we need the big guns to have these big conversations. Cause I don't know if you know this, but you know, Sarah's 20 and I just, and I got you. Fun fact, I can laugh about her being young. Cause this is what happened to me. You know what happened to me, Dahlia? I went to the doctor last week and I got my blood work back. And cause I've still got some high blood pressure going on. I got some other things going on. None of this stuff is correlated. So they wanted more tests, got all the tests back. Everything's normal except for four things. One of which is B12. The other is folate. And they were like, you should drink some Ovaltine.
Oh,
sorry.
She might be young, but I have been prescribed Ovaltine, which is a malted beverage, and it's a celiac. I cannot consume it, but I'm like, thanks.
Yeah, didn't they look at your chart? Why are they recommending things you can't have?
Right. No, well, because, you know, doctors aren't specifically necessarily trained in nutrition. They were like, oh, this isn't like a medical thing. This is like a nutritional thing.
Okay.
And that's an important thing to remember. Like, your average doctor. Thing. Your average doctor has like exactly 4 hours maybe of nutritional training during medical school because like they're, you know, dealing with like broken bones and like the virus and that have to be contained and whatnot. So there's a lot that goes into medical school and nutrition is kind of not necessarily there. So giving grace to doctors, you don't have to know. They're not expected to know, but they know when the issue is like medical versus food therapy and they want me to go have some Ovaltine. Yay! Ovaltine. I laugh at Sarah because if I was talking about me, I might cry.
Well, I've been feeling the old thing too. The other day I said, oh, well, I'm old. So dot, dot, dot. And the person asked me to say my age and it was way younger than them. And then I felt like an asshole. So I've been trying to throw that around less, but I'm like, I am old in comparison to the kindergartners I work with. You know, when I tell them how old I am, they're like, oh my God, I wonder if she'll be dead by Friday or she's, you know, it's very old to them. So because I spend so much time with people who by comparison are old, I don't really think I'm old, but I am old to a lot of people is what I think.
Yeah. Asking kids how old they think you are is a very fun game. First guess is 13 true. And then her second guess is 100.
Nothing in between. All or nothing, Sarah. All or nothing. Oh my God.
That's what everything's supposed to be like, right?
100%. Exactly.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Well, I did want to recommend a useful resource for me was Byron Katie's work because she has like a line of questioning you can use even if you're not in therapy. When you're having a thought, if you can start to try and look at the thought and really question it and tear it apart. And you can just Google that. She has basically four questions to help you break down negative thoughts. And yeah, I think it's helpful for some people.
I love it. There's a different path forward for everyone, but it starts with a little bit of positivity, a little Coach MK in your ear telling you exactly why you rock and what you have to work with, and the big guns reinforcing everything I say. Because sometimes when I say it, it's easy to dismiss. Like, oh, MK, you say this to everyone. MK, you're always so positive. It's taken 20 years of therapy to get here. There's a reason, y'all, but that's cool. You don't have to trust me. You can trust all the people, the team that I've assembled behind me. Thank you so much for being here, Dahlia. Thank you for showing up. As always, Jimmy, no matter what. Sarah, I wouldn't be here without you because I wouldn't know which Zoom link to click. So thank you, as always, for everything. Because, God, you are the wind beneath my wings. And all I do is sort of like flap around in circles if you aren't there to help me lift off. So thanks to everyone. Yay, team. We'll see you next week.
Yay. Bye.